To a woman, Signora, man's duties and responsibilities begin and end with the task of getting bread for her children. To her, man is only a means to an end of getting children and rearing them.
Is that your idea of a woman's mind? I call it cynical and disgusting animalism.
Pardon me, Anna, I said nothing about a woman's whole mind. I spoke of her view of man as a separate sex. It is no more cynical than her view of herself as, above all things, a mother. Sexually, woman is nature's contrivance for perpetuating its highest achievement. Sexually, man is woman's contrivance for fulfilling nature's behest in the most economical way. She knows, by instinct, that far back in the evolutional process, she invented him, differentiated him, created him in order to produce something better than the single-sex process can produce. Whilst he fulfills his purpose for which she made him, he is welcome to his dreams, his follies, his ideals, his heroisms, provided that the keystone of them all is the worship of woman, of motherhood, of the family, of the hearth. But how rash and dangerous it was to invent a separate creature whose sole function was her own impregnation. For mark what has happened. First, man has multiplied on her hands until there are as many men as women, so that she has been unable to employ for her purposes more than a fraction of the immense energy she has left at his disposal by saving him the exhausting labor of gestation. This superfluous energy has gone to his brain and to his muscle. He has become too strong to be controlled by her bodily, and too imaginative and mentally vigorous to be content with mere self-reproduction. He has invented civilization without consulting her, taking her domestic labor for granted as the foundation of it.
That is true at all events.
Yes, and this civilization, what is it after all?
After all, an excellent peg to hang your cynical commonplaces on. But before all, it is an attempt on man's part to make himself something more than the mere instrument of woman's purpose. So far, the result of life's continual effort, not only to maintain itself, but to achieve higher and higher organization and completer self-consciousness, is only, at best, a doubtful campaign between its forces and the forces of death and degeneration. The battles in this campaign are mere blunders, mostly won like actual military battles in spite of the commanders.
That is a dig at me.
No matter, go on, go on. No, it is a dig at a much higher power than you, Commander. Still, you must have noticed in your profession that even a stupid general can win battles when the enemy's general is a little stupider.
Most true, Juan, most true. Some donkeys have amazing luck.
Well, the life force is stupid, but it is not so stupid as the forces of death and degeneration. Besides, these are in its pay all the time. And so life wins after a fashion. What mere copiousness of the country can supply, and mere greed preserve, we possess. The survival of whatever form of civilization can produce the best rifle and the best-fed rifleman is assured.
Exactly. The survival, not the most effective means of life, but the most effective means of death. You always come back to my point. In spite of your wrigglings and evasions and sophistries, not to mention the intolerable length of your speeches.
Oh, come, come now. Who began making long speeches? However, if I overtax your intellect, you can leave us and seek the society of love and beauty and the rest of your favorite boredoms.
This is not fair, Señor Don Juan, and not civil. I am also on the intellectual plane. Nobody can appreciate it more than I do. I am arguing fairly with you, and I think utterly refuting you. Let us go on for another hour, if you like.
Good. Let us.
Not that I see any prospects of your coming to any point in particular, Juan.
My point, you marble-headed old masterpiece, is only a step ahead of you. Are we agreed that life is a force which has made innumerable experiments in organizing itself? That the mammoth and the man, the mouse and the megatherium, the flies and the fleas and the fathers of the church are all, more or less, successful attempts to build up that raw force into higher and higher individuals? The idea, individual being, omnipotent, omniscient, infallible, and withal completely, unalludedly self-conscious, in short, a god?
I agree for the sake of argument. I agree for the sake of avoiding argument.
I most emphatically disagree as regards the fathers of the church, and I must beg you not to drag them into the argument.
I did so purely for the sake of alliteration, Anna, and I shall make no further allusion to them. And now, since we are, with that exception, agreed so far, will you not agree with me further that life has not measured the success of its attempts at godhead by the beauty or bodily perfection of the result? Since in both these respects, the birds, as our friend Aristophanes long ago pointed out, are so extraordinarily superior with their power of flight and their lovely plumage and, may I add, the touching poetry of their loves and nestings, that it is inconceivable that life, having once produced them, should, if love and beauty were her object, start off on another line and labor at the clumsy elephant and the hideous ape whose grandchildren we are.
Aristophanes was a heathen, and you, Juan, I'm afraid, are very little better.
You conclude, then, that life was driving at clumsiness and ugliness?
No, perverse devil that you are, 1,000 times no. Life was driving at brains, at its darling object, an organ by which it can attain not only self-consciousness, but self-understanding.
Well, this is all metaphysics, Juan. Why the devil should...
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Oh, pray, don't mention it. I have always regarded the use of my name to secure additional emphasis as a high compliment to me. It is entirely at your service, Commander.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very good of you. Even in heaven, I never quite got out of my old military habits of speech. And what I was going to ask Juan was, why life should bother itself about getting a brain? Why should it want to understand itself? Why not be content to enjoy itself?
Without a brain, Commander, you would enjoy yourself without knowing it, and so lose all the fun.
True. Most true. Still, I am content with brain enough to know that I'm enjoying myself. I don't want to understand why. In fact, I'd rather not. My experience is that one's pleasures don't bear thinking about. That is why intellect is so unpopular. But to life, the force behind the man, intellect is a necessity, because without it he plunders into death. Just as life, after ages of struggle, evolved that wonderful bodily organ, the eye, so that the living organism could see where it was going, and what was coming to help or threaten it, and thus avoid 1,000 dangers that formerly slew it, so it is evolving today a mind's eye that shall see not the physical world, but the purpose of life, and thereby enable the individual to work for that purpose instead of thwarting and baffling it by setting up short-sighted personal aims as at present. Even as it is, only one sort of man has ever been happy, has ever been universally respected among all the conflicts of interests and illusions.
You mean the military man?
I am sorry, Commander, I do not mean the military man. When the military man approaches, the world locks up its spoons and packs off its womankind. No, I sing not arms and the hero, but the philosophic man, he who seeks in contemplation to discover the inner will of the world, in invention to discover the means of fulfilling that will, and in action to do that will by this so discovered means. Of all other sorts of men, I declare myself tired. They are tedious failures. When I was on Earth, professors of all sorts prowled around me, feeling for an unhealthy spot in me on which they could fasten. The doctors of medicine made me consider what I must do to save my body and offered me quack cures for imaginary diseases. I replied that I was not a hypochondriac, so they called me ignoramus and went their way. The doctors of divinity bade me consider what I must do to save my soul. But I was not a spiritual hypochondriac any more than a bodily one, and would not trouble myself about that either. So they called me atheist and went their way. After them came the politician, who said there was only one purpose in nature, and that was to get him into Parliament. I told him I did not care whether he got into Parliament or not, so he called me Mugwump and went his way. Then came the romantic man, the artist, with his love songs and his paintings and his poems, and with him I had great delight for many years, and some profit, for I cultivated my senses for his sake, and his songs taught me to hear better, his paintings to see better, and his poems to feel more deeply. But he led me at last into the worship of woman.
Juan!
Yes, I came to believe that in her voice was all the music of the song, in her face all the beauty of the painting, and in her soul all the emotion of the poem.
And you were disappointed, I suppose. Well, was it her fault that you attributed all these perfections to her?
Yes, partly. For with a wonderful, instinctive cunning, she kept silent and allowed me to glorify her, to mistake my own visions, thoughts, and feelings for hers. Now, my friend the romantic man was often too poor or too timid to approach those women who were beautiful or refined enough to seem to realize his ideal, and so he went to his grave believing in his dream. But I was more favored by nature and circumstance. I was of noble birth and rich, and when my person did not please, my conversation flattered, though I generally found myself fortunate in both.
Coxcomb. Yes, but even my coxcombry pleased. Well, I found that when I had touched a woman's imagination, she would allow me to persuade myself that she loved me. But when my suit was granted, she never said, "I am happy. My love is satisfied." She always said first, "At last, the barriers are down." And second, "When will you come again?"
That is exactly what men say.
I protest, I never said it. But all women say it. Well, these two speeches always alarmed me, for the first meant that the lady's impulse had been solely to throw down my fortifications and gain my citadel, and the second openly announced that henceforth she regarded me as her property, and counted my time as already wholly at her disposal.
That is where your want of heart came in.
You shouldn't repeat what a woman says, Juan.
It should be sacred to you.
Still, I certainly do always say it. I never minded the barriers, but there was always a slight shock about the other, unless one was very hard hit indeed.
Then the lady, who had been happy and idle enough before, became anxious, preoccupied with me, always intriguing, conspiring, pursuing, watching, waiting, bent wholly on making sure of her prey, I being the prey, you understand. Now, this was not what I had bargained for. It may have been very proper and very natural, but it was not music, painting, poetry, and joy incarnated in a beautiful woman. I ran away from it. I ran away from it very often. In fact, I became famous for running away from it.
Infamous, you mean?
I did not run away from you. Do you blame me for running away from the others?
Nonsense, man. You are talking to a woman of 77 now. If you had had the chance, you would have run away from me, too, if I had let you. You would not have found it so easy with me as with the others. If men will not be faithful to their home and their duties, they must be made to be. I dare say you all want to marry lovely incarnations of music and painting and poetry. Well, you can't have them because they don't exist. If flesh and blood is not good enough for you, you must do without, that's all. Women have to put up with flesh and blood husbands, and a little enough of that, too, sometimes. And you have to put up with flesh and blood wives. I see you don't like that, any of you, but it's true for all that. So if you don't like it, you can lump it.
My dear lady, you have put my whole case against romance into a few sentences. That is just why I turned my back on the romantic man with his artistic nature, as he called his infatuation. I thanked him for teaching me to use my eyes and ears, but I told him that his beauty-worshipping and happiness-hunting and woman-idealizing was not worth a dump as a philosophy of life. So he called me Philistine and went his way.
It seems that woman taught you something, too, with all her defects.
She did more. She interpreted all the other teachings for me. Ah, my friends, when the barriers were down for the first time, what an astounding illumination. I had been prepared for infatuation, for intoxication, for all the illusions of love's young dream. And yet, never was my perception clearer, nor my criticism more ruthless. The most jealous rival of my mistress never saw every blemish in her more keenly than I. I was not duped. I took her without chloroform.
But you did take her.
That was the revelation. Up to that point, I had never lost the sense of being my own master. Never consciously taken a single step until my reason had examined and approved it. I had come to believe that I was a purely rational creature, a thinker. I said with the foolish philosopher, I think, therefore I am. It was woman who taught me to say, I am, therefore I think. And also, I would think more, therefore I must be more. But this is extremely abstract and metaphysical, Juan. If you would stick to the concrete and put your discoveries in the form of entertaining anecdotes about your adventures with women, your conversation would be easier to follow. Ah, what need I add? Do you not understand that when I stood face to face with woman, every fiber in my clear, critical brain warned me to spare her and save myself? My morals said no. My conscience said no. My chivalry and pity for her said no. My prudent regard for myself said no. My ear, practiced on 1,000 songs and symphonies, my eye, exercised on 1,000 paintings, tore her voice, her features, her color to shreds. I caught all those telltale resemblances to her father and mother by which I knew what she would be like in 30 years' time. I noted the gleam of gold from a dead tooth and a laughing mouth. I made curious observations of the strange odors of the chemistry of the nerves, the visions of my romantic reveries in which I had trod the plains of heaven with a deathless, ageless creature of coral and ivory deserted me in that supreme hour. I remembered them and desperately strove to recover their illusions, but they now seemed the emptiest of inventions. My judgment was not to be corrupted. My brain still said no on every issue. And whilst I was in the act of framing my excuse to the lady, life seized me and threw me into her arms as a sailor throws a scrap of fish into the mouth of a seabird. Oh, you might just as well have gone without thinking such a lot about it, Juan. You are like all clever men. You have more brains than is good for you. And were you not the happier for the experience, Señor Don Juan? The happier? No. The wiser, yes. That moment introduced me for the first time to myself, and through myself to the world. I saw then how useless it was to attempt to impose conditions on the irresistible force of life, to preach prudence, careful selection, virtue, honor, chastity.
Don Juan, a word against chastity is an insult to me.
I said nothing against your chastity, Senora, since it took the form of a husband and 12 children. What more could you have done had you been the most abandoned of women?
I could have had 12 husbands and no children. That's what I could have done. And let me tell you that that would have made all the difference to the earth, which I replenished.
Bravo, Anna! Juan, you are floored, quelled, annihilated. No, for though that difference is the true essential difference, Doniana has, I admit, gone straight to the real point. Yet it is not a difference of love or chastity, or even constancy. For 12 children by 12 different husbands would have replenished the earth perhaps more effectively. Suppose my friend Ottavio had died when you were 30. You would never have remained a widow, you were too beautiful. Suppose the successor of Ottavio had died when you were 40. You would still have been irresistible. And a woman who marries twice marries 3 times if she becomes free to do so. 12 lawful children born by 1 highly respectable lady to 3 different fathers is not impossible, nor condemned by public opinion. That such a lady may be more law-abiding than the poor girl whom we used to spurn into the gutter for bearing 1 unlawful infant is no doubt true, but dare you say she is less self-indulgent?
She is less virtuous. That is enough for me.
In that case, what is virtue but the trade unionism of the married? Let us face facts, dear Anna. The life force respects marriage only because marriage is a contrivance of its own to secure the greatest number of children and the closest care of them. For honor, chastity, and the rest of your moral figments, it cares not a rap. Marriage is the most licentious of human institutions.
What?
Really?
I say the most licentious of human institutions. That is the secret of its popularity. And a woman seeking a husband is the most unscrupulous of all beasts of prey. The confusion of marriage with morality has done more to destroy the conscience of the human race than any other single error. Come, Anna, do not look shocked. You know better than any of us that marriage is a man-trap baited with simulated accomplishments and elusive idealizations. When your sainted mother, by dint of scoldings and punishments, forced you to learn how to play a half a dozen pieces on the spinet, which she hated as much as you did, had she any other purpose than to delude your suitors into the belief that your husband would have in his home an angel who would fill it with melody, or at least play him to sleep after dinner? You married my friend Ottavio. Did you ever once open the spinet from the hour when the church united him to you?
You are a fool, Juan. A young married woman has something else to do than sit at the spinet without any support for her back, so she gets out of the habit of playing.
Not if she loves music. No, believe me, she only throws away the bait when the bird is in the net.
And men, I suppose, never throw off the mask when their bird is in the net. The husband never becomes negligent, selfish, brutal. Oh, never.
What do these recriminations prove, Anna? Only that the hero is as gross an impostor as the heroine.
It is all nonsense. Most marriages are perfectly comfortable.
Perfectly is a strong expression, Anna. What you mean is that sensible people make the best of one another. Those who talk most about the blessings of marriage and the constancy of its vows are the very people who declare that if the chains were broken and the prisoners left free to choose, the whole social fabric would fly asunder. You cannot have the argument both ways. If the prisoner is happy, why lock him in? If he is not, why pretend that he is?
At all events, let me take an old woman's privilege again and tell you flatly that marriage peoples the world and debauchery does not.
How if a time come when this shall cease to be true? Do you not know that where there is a will, there is a way? That whatever man really wishes to do, he will finally discover a means of doing? Well, you have done your best, you virtuous ladies, and others of your way of thinking, to bend man's mind wholly towards honorable love as the highest good, and to understand by honorable love romance and beauty and happiness in the possession of beautiful, refined, delicate, affectionate women. You have taught women to value their own youth, health, shapeliness, and refinement above all things. Well, what place have squalling babies and household cares in this exquisite paradise of the senses and emotions? Is it not the inevitable end of it all that the human shall say to the human brain, invent me a means by which I can have love, beauty, romance, emotion, passion, without their wretched penalties, their expenses, their worries, their trials, their illnesses and agonies and risks of death, their retinue of servants and nurses and doctors and schoolmasters? All this, Señor Don Juan, is realized here in my realm. Yes, at the cost of death. Man will not take it at that price. He demands the romantic delights of your hell whilst he is still on earth. Well, the means will be found. The brain will not fail when the will is in earnest. The day is coming when great nations will find their numbers dwindling from census to census, when the six-room villa will rise in price above the family mansion, when the viciously reckless poor and the stupidly pious rich will delay the extinction of the race only by degrading it, whilst the boldly prudent, the thriftily selfish and ambitious, the imaginative and poetic, the lovers of money and solid comfort, the worshippers of success, art, life, and love, will all oppose to the force of life the device of sterility. That is all very eloquent, my young friend. But if you had lived to Anna's age, or even to mine, you'd have learnt that the young man who gets rid of the fear of poverty and children and all the other family troubles and devotes himself to having a good time of it only leaves his mind free for the fear of old age and ugliness and impotence and death. And the childless laborer is more tormented by his wife's idleness and her constant demands for amusement than he would be by 20 children. And his wife is more wretched than he. I've had my share of vanity, for as a young man I was admired by women, and as a statue I am praised by art critics. But I confess that had I found nothing to do in the world but wallow in these delights, I should have cut my throat. When I married Anna's mother, or perhaps to be strictly correct, when I at last gave in and allowed Anna's mother to marry me, I knew that I was planting thorns in my pillow, and that marriage, for me, a swaggering young officer, hitherto unvanquished, meant defeat and capture.
Father!
Well, I'm sorry to shock you, my love, but since Juan has stripped every rag of decency from this discussion, I may as well tell the frozen truth.
And I suppose I was one of the thorns.
Oh, by no means. You were very often a rose. No, your mother had most of the trouble you gave. Then may I ask, Commander, why you have left heaven to come here and wallow, as you express it, in the sentimental beatitudes which you confess would once have driven you to cut your throat?
Gad, that's true. What, are you going back on your word? Does your demonstration of the approaching sterilization and extinction of mankind lead to anything better than taking the...
I never demonstrated the extinction of mankind. Life cannot will its own extinction. I had not finished when His Excellency interrupted me.
I begin to doubt whether you will ever finish, my friend.
You are extremely fond of hearing yourself talk, and that's very true. But since you have endured so much, you may as well endure to the end. Long before this sterilization which I described becomes more than a clearly foreseen possibility, the reaction will begin. The great central purpose of breeding the race. Yes, breeding it to heights now deemed superhuman. That purpose, which is now hidden in a fastidious cloud of love and romance and prudery, will break through into clear sunlight. As a purpose no longer to be confused with the gratification of personal fancies, the impossible realization of boys and girls' dreams of bliss, or the need of older people for companionship or money. No, do my sex the justice to admit, Signora, that we have always recognized that the sex relation is not a personal or friendly relation at all.
Not a personal or friendly relation? What relation is more personal, more sacred, more holy?
Sacred and holy if you like, Anna, but not personally friendly. I had always found that my proposals to a woman were wholly the outcome of a perfectly simple impulse of my manhood toward her womanhood.
You mean it was an immoral impulse?
Nature, my dear lady, is what you call immoral. I blush for it, but I cannot help it. Nature is a pander. Time a wrecker and death a murderer. I have always preferred to stand up to these facts and build institutions on their recognition. You prefer to propitiate the three devils by proclaiming their chastity, their thrift, and their loving kindness. And to base your institutions on these flatteries? Is it any wonder that the institutions do not work smoothly?
One.
Yes, Commander. You're still extremely abstract. I'm sorry, Commander. And tell me, what used the ladies to say?
Commander, confidence for confidence. First tell me what you used to say to the ladies.
I? Oh, I swore that I would be faithful to the death, that I should die if they refused me, that no woman could possibly be to me what she was.
She? Who?
Well, whoever it happened to be at the time, my dear. I had certain things I always said. One of them was,
that even when I was 80, one white hair of the woman I loved would make me tremble more than the thickest gold tress from the most beautiful young head. Another was that I could not bear the thought of anyone else being the mother of my children.
You old rascal.
Not a bit of it, for I really believed it with all my soul at the moment I had a heart. Not like you. And it was this sincerity that made me successful.
Sincerity? To be fool enough to believe a stamping, thumping lie? Sincerity, you call it? To be so greedy for a woman that you deceive yourself in your eagerness to deceive her? Sincerity?
Oh, damn your sophistries. I was a man in love, not a lawyer.
And the women loved me for it, bless them. They made you think so. What would you say when I tell you that though I played the lawyer so carelessly, they made me think so, too? I also had my moments of infatuation when I gushed nonsense and believed it. Sometimes the desire to give pleasure by saying beautiful things so rose in me on the flood of emotion that I said them recklessly. At other times, I argued against myself with a devilish coldness that drew tears. But I found that it was just as hard to escape in one case as the other. When the woman's instinct was set on me, there was nothing for it but lifelong servitude or flight.
You dare boast before me and my father that every woman found you irresistible?
Am I boasting? It seems to me I cut the most pitiable of figures. Besides, I said when the lady's instinct was set on me, it was not always so. And then, heavens, what transports of virtuous indignation! What overwhelming defiance to their dastardly seducer! What scenes of Imogen and Iachimo!
I made no scenes. I simply called my father.
And he came, sword in hand, to vindicate outraged honor and morality by murdering me.
Murdering? What do you mean? Did I kill you or did you kill me?
Which one of us was the better fencer?
I was.
Of course you were. And yet you, the hero of those scandalous adventures you have just been relating to us, you had the effrontery to pose as the avenger of outraged morality and condemn me to death. You would have slain me but for an accident.
I was expected to, Juan. That is how things were arranged on Earth. I was not a social reformer, and I always did what was customary for a gentleman to do.
That may account for your attacking me, but not for the revolting hypocrisy of your subsequent proceedings as a statue.
That all came of my going to heaven.
I still fail to see, Señor Don Juan, that these episodes in your earthly career, and in that of Señor Commander, in any way discredit my view of life. Here, I repeat, you have all that you sought without anything that you shrank from.
On the contrary, here I have everything that disappointed me without anything that I have not already tried and found wanting. I tell you that as long as I can conceive of something better than myself, I cannot be easy unless I am striving to bring it into existence, or clearing the way for it. That is the law of my life. That is the working within me of life's incessant aspiration to higher organization, wider, deeper, intenser self-consciousness, and clearer self-understanding. It was the supremacy of this purpose that reduced love for me to the mere pleasure of a moment, art for me to the mere schooling of my faculties, religion for me to a mere excuse for laziness, since it had set up a god who looked at the world and saw that it was good, against the instinct in me that looked through my eyes at the world and saw that it could be improved. I tell you that in the pursuit of my own pleasure, my own health, my own fortune, I have never known happiness. It was not love for woman that delivered me into her hands. It was fatigue, exhaustion. When I was a child and bruised my head against a stone, I ran to the nearest woman and cried away my pain against her apron. When I grew up and bruised my soul against the brutalities and stupidities with which I had to strive, I did again just what I had done as a child. I have enjoyed, too, my rests, my recuperations, my breathing times, my very prostrations after strife, but rather would I be dragged through all the circles of a foolish Italian's inferno than through the pleasures of Europe. That is what has made this place of eternal pleasure so deadly to me. It is the absence of this instinct in you that makes you that strange monster called the devil. It is the success with which you have diverted the attention of men from their real purpose, which in one degree or another is the same as mine, to yours, that has earned you the name of the tempter. It is the fact that they are doing your will, or rather, drifting with your want of will, instead of doing their own, that makes them the uncomfortable, false, restless, artificial, petulant, wretched creatures they are.
Señor Don Juan, you are uncivil to my friends.
Why should I be civil to them? Or to you? In this palace of lies, a truth or two will not hurt you. Your friends are all the dullest dogs I know. They are not beautiful. They are only decorated. They are not clean. They are only shaved and starched. They are not dignified. They are only fashionably dressed. They are not educated. They are only college passmen. They are not religious. They are only pew renters. They are not moral. They are only conventional. They are not virtuous. They are only cowardly. They are not even vicious. They are only frail. They are not artistic. They are only lascivious. They are not prosperous, only rich. Not loyal. They are only servile, not dutiful, only sheepish, not public-spirited, only patriotic. Not courageous, only quarrelsome. Not determined, only obstinate. Not masterful, only domineering. Not self-controlled, only obtuse. Not self-respecting, only vain. Not kind, only sentimental. Not social, only gregarious. Not considerate, only polite. Not intelligent, only opinionated. Not progressive, only factious. Not imaginative, only superstitious. Not just, only vindictive. Not generous, only propitiatory. Not disciplined, only cowed. And not truthful at all. Liars. Every one of them. To the very backbone of their souls. You know, your flow of words is simply amazing, Juan. How I wish I could have talked like that to my soldiers.
It is mere talk, though. It has all been said before, but what change has it ever made? What notice has the world ever taken of it?
Yes, it is mere talk. But why is it mere talk? Because, my friend, beauty, purity, respectability, religion, morality, art, patriotism, bravery, and all the rest, they are nothing but words, which I or anyone else can turn inside out like a glove. Were they realities, you would have to plead guilty to my indictment. But fortunately for your self-respect, my diabolical friend, they are not realities. As you say, they are mere words. Useful for duping barbarians into adopting civilization, or the civilized poor into submitting to be robbed and enslaved. That is the family secret of the governing caste. And if we, who are of that caste, aimed at more life for the world, instead of at more power and luxury for our miserable selves, that secret would make us great. Now, since I, being a nobleman, am in the secret too, think how tedious to me must be your unending cant about all these moralistic figments, and how squalidly disastrous your sacrifice of your lives to them. If you even believed in your moral game enough to play it fairly, it would be interesting to watch, but you don't. You cheat at every trick, and if your opponent outcheats you, you upset the table and try to murder him.
On earth there may be some truth in this, because the people are uneducated and cannot appreciate my religion of love and beauty. But here...
Oh, yes, I know. Here there is nothing but love and beauty. It is like sitting for all eternity in the first act of a fashionable play, before the complications begin. Never in my worst moments of superstitious terror on earth did I dream that hell was so horrible. I lived like a hairdresser in the continual contemplation of beauty, toying with silken tresses. I breathed an atmosphere of sweetness
like a confectioner's shop boy. Commander, are there any beautiful women in heaven?
None. Absolutely none. All dowdies. Not two pennies worth of jewelry among a dozen of them. They might be men. Of 50.
I am impatient to get there. Is the word beauty ever mentioned? Are there any artistic people?
Oh, I give you my word, they won't admire a fine statue even when it walks past them. I go.
Don Juan, shall I be frank with you?
Were you not so before?
Well, as far as I went, yes, but I will now go further and confess to you that men get tired of everything. Of heaven, no less than of hell. And that all history is nothing but a record of the oscillations of the world between these two extremes. An epoch is but a swing of the pendulum. And each generation thinks the world is progressing because it is always moving. But when you are as old as I am, when you have 1,000 times wearied of heaven, like myself and the commander, and 1,000 times wearied of hell, as you are wearied now, you will no longer imagine that every swing from heaven to hell is an emancipation, every swing from hell to heaven an evolution. Where you now see reform, progress, fulfillment of upward tendency, continual ascent by man on the stepping stones of his dead self to higher things, you will see nothing but an infinite comedy of illusion. You will discover the profound truth of the saying of my friend Koheleth, in the Bible, you know, that there is nothing new under the sun, vanitas vanitatum.
By heaven, this is worse than your cant about love and beauty. Clever dolt that you are, is a man no better than a worm or a dog than a wolf because he gets tired of everything? Shall he give up eating because he destroys his appetite in the act of gratifying it? Is a field idle when it is fallow? Can the commander expend his hellish energy here without accumulating heavenly energy for his next term of blessedness? Granted that the great life force has hit on the device of the clockmaker's pendulum and uses the earth for its bulb, that the history of each oscillation, which seems so novel to us, the actors, is but the history of the last oscillation repeated. Nay, more, that in the unthinkable infinitude of time, the sun throws off the earth and catches it again 1,000 times, as a circus rider throws off a ball, and that the total of all our epochs is but the moments between the toss and the catch. Has the colossal mechanism no purpose?
None, my friend. You think because you have a purpose, nature must have one? You might as well expect it to have fingers and toes because you have them.
Ah, but I should not have them if they serve no purpose. And I, my friend, am as much a part of nature as my own finger is a part of me. If my finger is the organ by which I grasp the sword and the mandolin, my brain is the organ by which nature strives to understand itself. My dog's brain serves only my dog's purposes. But my brain labors at a knowledge which does nothing for me personally but to make my body bitter to me, and my decay and my death a calamity. Were I not possessed with a purpose beyond my own, I had better be a ploughman than a philosopher, for the ploughman lives as long as the philosopher, eats more, sleeps better, and rejoices in the wife of his bosom with less misgivings. This is because the philosopher is in the grip of the life force. This life force says to him, I have done 1,000 wonderful things unconsciously, by merely willing to live, and following the line of least resistance. Now I want to know myself and my destination, and choose my path. So I have made a special brain, a philosopher's brain, to grasp this knowledge for me, as the husbandman's hand grasps the plough for me. And this, says the life force to the philosopher, must thou strive to do for me until thou diest, when I will make another brain, and another philosopher to carry on the work.
What is the use of knowing?
Why, to be able to choose the line of greatest advantage, instead of yielding in the direction of the least resistance. Does a ship sail to its destination no better than a log drifts nowhere? The philosopher is nature's pilot. And there you have our difference. To be in hell is to drift. To be in heaven is to steer.
On the rocks, most likely.
Which ship goes oftenest on the rocks? The drifting ship or the ship with a pilot on board?
Well, 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 go your way, Señor Don Juan. I prefer to be my own master and not the tool of any blundering universal force. I know that beauty is good to look at, that music is good to hear, that love is good to feel, that they are all good to think about and talk about. I know that to be well exercised in these sensations, emotions, and studies is to be a refined and cultivated being. Whatever they may say of me in churches on earth, I know that it is universally admitted in good society that the Prince of Darkness is a gentleman, and that is enough for me. As to your life force, which you think irresistible, it is the most resistible thing in the world for a person of any character. But if you are naturally vulgar and credulous, as all reformers are, it will thrust you first into religion, where you will sprinkle water on babies to save their souls from me. Then it will drive you from religion into science, where you will snatch the babies from the water sprinkling and inoculate them with disease to save them from catching it accidentally. Then you will take to politics, where you will become the cat's paw of corrupt functionaries and the henchmen of ambitious humbugs. And the end will be despair and decrepitude, broken nerve and shattered hopes, vain regrets for that worst and silliest of wastes and sacrifices, the waste and sacrifice of the power of enjoyment. In a word, the punishment of the fool who pursues the better before he has secured the good.
But at least I shall not be bored. The service of the life force has that advantage at all events. So, fare you well, Señor Satan.
Fare you well, Don Juan. I shall often think of our interesting chats about things in general. I wish you every happiness. Heaven, as I said before, suits some people. But if you should change your mind, do not forget that the gates are always open here to the repentant prodigal, if you feel at any time that warmth of heart, sincere, unforced affection, innocent enjoyment, and warm, breathing, palpitating reality.
Why not say flesh and blood at once? Though we have left those two greasy commonplaces behind us.
Well, you throw my friendly farewell back in my teeth, then, Don Juan.
By no means. But though there is much to be learned from a cynical devil, I really cannot stand a sentimental one. Señor Commander, you know the way to the frontier of heaven and hell. Be good enough to direct me.
Oh, the frontier is only the difference between two ways of looking at things. Any road will take you there, if you really want to get there.
Good. Señora, your servant.
But I am going with you.
I can find my own way to heaven, Anna, but I cannot find yours.
How annoying.
Bon voyage, Juan.
He wafts a final blast of his great rolling chords after him as a parting salute. A faint echo of the first ghostly melody comes back in acknowledgement.
There he goes. Phew, how he does talk. They'll never stand it in heaven.
His going is a political defeat. I cannot keep these life worshippers. They all go. This is the greatest loss I've had since that Dutch painter went. A fellow who would paint a hag of 70 with as much enjoyment as a Venus of 20.
Oh, I remember. He came to heaven. Rembrandt.
Yes, Rembrandt. There is something unnatural about these fellows. Do not listen to their gospel, Señor Commander. It is dangerous. Beware of the pursuit of the superhuman. It leads to an indiscriminate contempt for the human. To a man, horses and dogs and cats are a mere species outside the moral world. Well, to the superman, men and women are a mere species too, also outside the moral world. This Don Juan was kind to women and courteous to men, as your daughter here was kind to her pet cats and dogs. But such kindness is a denial of the exclusively human character of the soul.
And who the deuce is the Superman?
Oh, it is the latest fashion among the life force fanatics. It is as old as Prometheus, and the 20th century will run after this newest of the old crazes when it gets tired of the world, the flesh, and your humble servant.
Superman is a good cry, and a good cry is half the battle.
And now, my friend, let us hasten to my palace and celebrate your arrival with a grand musical service.
Ah, with pleasure. You're most kind.
This way, Commander. We go down by the old trapdoor.
Good. All the same, Superman is a fine conception. There's something statuesque about it. Ah, this reminds me of old times.
Me also. Wait. You, Signora, cannot come this way. You will have an apotheosis, but you will be at the palace before us. That is not what I stopped you for. Tell me, where can I find the Superman? He is not yet created, Signora.
And never will be, probably. Let us proceed. The red fire will make me sneeze.
Not yet created. Then my work is not yet done. I believe in the life to come. A father. A father for the Superman.